Hello and welcome to the National Oceanography Centre's Into the Blue podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Zoe Jacobs. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Mike Clare for the final part of this two-part special all about plastics and the effects they have on our ocean. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us today.
No problem.
Good to see you. So before we get into the details, I thought it would be really great if you could tell us how you got into this line of work, because you didn't actually start your career in academia, did you?
No, that's right. I mean, I did a geology degree originally and was really interested in dinosaurs and volcanoes and that sort of thing, I think, as every kid is. Then did the geology degree and kind of went looking for something to do. I was pretty adamant at the time. I didn't want to do research at all. I wanted to go and get some experience doing something totally different. So I ended up working for a company that did surveys and site investigations for all sorts of offshore infrastructure. So things like cables and pipelines, offshore oil and gas and renewables. And so my background really was getting to grips with trying to understand the natural hazards that can impact those things. And the more I started looking into them, the more I realised we really don't know an awful lot about these processes and a whole load of other things that happen in the deep sea. And that got me interested. And then I started coming back to the scientific literature and getting excited by things, and then accidentally found myself coming back to the National Oceanography Centre to do a PhD. And very much focused on that area. So studying landslides, which can be far bigger than those landslides that happen on land, and they happen for apparently unknown reasons. So some of the biggest landslides on our planet happen on the seafloor. They can be bigger than the area of Scotland, for example, and fail on slopes less than 1 degree. That's the angle of a Premier League football pitch. So that sort of thing shouldn't fail on land, but it does under the sea. So that really kind of got me going and wanting to learn more about that sort of thing.
That's cool. So that's interesting, actually. I'm not sure how many people have heard of kind of landslides under the sea, because we know about, obviously, the landslides on land. So why do we actually care about these kind of hazards under the sea, then? What's the kind of societal implication, if any?
So the societal implication, there's many. So the first thing links back to the job I was doing in industry. So at the moment, most people aren't aware, but more than 99% of all digital data traffic, that's the internet, it's Facebook, it's Twitter, relies on submarine cables. About 1% goes via satellite. And these cables every so often break. Sometimes it's mostly to do with human causes like fishing, but every so often multiple cables break. And these were some of the first observations we ever had that these underwater landslides happened. Cables were breaking hundreds of kilometres from shore and breaking one after another. And we could then start to see that these huge landslides can happen. But the landslides can also displace the water on top of them. If they're very big, it's like throwing a big rock into a big bathtub. They create tsunami waves as well. And so most tsunami are created by earthquakes, but every so often they're created by landslides. And they're quite unpredictable. We don't know a lot about them. But obviously for coastal communities, there's a very big impact potentially.
Yeah, my gosh, that sounds it. So moving on to the kind of main topic of this podcast, which is microplastics. Blah, blah, blah. So can you tell us what we currently know about plastics getting transported into the ocean and across it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that kind of, it seems like a big leap from landslides to microplastics. But part of the thing that I study and want to understand is how do sediments, so sand and mud, get transported from land to the deep sea? And one thing that gets transported from the land to the deep sea is litter, pollutants. And increasingly, we're starting to see that tiny fragments and fibres that are maybe less than 1 millimetre in size, microplastics, are also getting transported. So I was discussing with colleagues and said, well, how important might the processes that we study on the deep sea actually be for transporting microplastics? There's, in the last 10 years, maybe been a really big increase in the number of people studying microplastics. And everywhere we go, we find them. They're found on the top of Mount Everest. They're being transported by winds. And in the ocean, there's been a significant amount of work that has shown that surface currents, so waves and other things that drive currents, they can concentrate and focus microplastics and plastics of all sorts into different places, into these tropical gyres. And so they can concentrate them. And you've probably heard of things like the floating garbage patches in the ocean that are probably not actually like an island of plastic. It's more like a plastic soup. But a significant amount of that is these bits, these tiny bits of plastic, microplastics. When people have started looking at how much plastic there is floating on the ocean, have actually found that based on the amount of plastic that we've put into the ocean, there's maybe only 1% that's actually floating on the surface of the ocean. So we're missing 99% of that plastic, and it's somewhere else. I think you've spoken to Richard Lampitt, who's demonstrated with Katsia Pabatsava here at the Oceanography Centre, that a lot of that microplastics is actually floating around below the surface. Mm. What we started looking into was saying, well, where does it actually end up?
Mm.
More than 50% of plastic actually sinks naturally, and all sorts of other biological effects, kind of the snots that different sorts of organisms in the ocean create, can make that plastic sink.
Yeah.
So its ultimate fate, its ultimate resting place, is presumably on the seafloor.
Right.
So we started thinking about, well, how can we investigate that?
Mm.
And that's really kind of what got me interested in microplastics, is where do these bits go? And in this case, these bits are microplastics and not sand and mud.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So as you said, we did touch on that in our previous podcast with Richard Lampitt, how kind of only 1% of the plastic we can actually see, which is on the surface, but there's so much kind of throughout the water column, and as you say, on the seafloor. So presumably then this plastic enters the ocean from, I guess the main sites would be from rivers, from boats and things like that.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So there's still a lot of debate, and there's still a lot of, we still need more evidence. We need to do the stamp collecting really to understand what the sources of plastics are. But it's there's significant evidence that it's rivers that transport a lot of plastics, and particularly in areas where there's a lot of mismanaged plastic waste.
Yeah.
There are extremely big rivers, so areas in Southeast Asia, for example, are disproportionately responsible for transporting plastics. But work that's been done here by colleagues at the Oceanography Centre has also demonstrated, exactly as you say, ships, but fishing. So in some areas of the ocean, say the Northeast Atlantic, if you go to submarine canyons, and these are, imagine the Grand Canyon, but underwater. Mm. If you go into the middle of these canyons, quite often what you find is snagged around cold water corals that are there, is bits of fishing gear.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And in those places, the plastic could be 80, 90% of the plastic that you find. So it really depends on where you are, but it also depends on what processes are transporting that plastic.
Mm.
Until fairly recently, most studies have looked at how plastic gets transported across land and to get to sea. So there's a river, but they kind of stop there. And so there's an arrow that goes out, and somewhere in the sea here be plastic, but where does it end up?
Yeah, and presumably this is where we come in.
Absolutely where we come in. It's definitely, and so this is the bit that really got me going, was to say, well, we study these currents that can happen on the sea floor.
Mm.
So there's currents on the surface of the ocean, there's currents in the water column. I study things, either avalanches of sediment that travel down submarine canyons that could be triggered by underwater landslides, or the global conveyor belt of currents, which are driven by changes in the temperature and salinity in different parts of the ocean. So we started thinking, well, can we go to places where you have the influence of these currents on the seafloor? And do we see differences in concentrations of the microplastics on the seafloor? And that's very much what we found. So we went to the Tyrrhenian Sea, so in the Western Mediterranean. Went down to the deep sea there, far from shore, and found the biggest concentrations of microplastics anyone's ever found on the seafloor.
Oh, wow.
And these conveyor belts are effectively sorting the plastic. So when the currents get too fast, they get sprayed along the seafloor. But next to those points, they're accumulating in what we call microplastic hotspots.
Right.
And unfortunately, these are also the places where you get a lot of benthic biodiversity. So lots of important but vulnerable organisms live there, because the same currents bring them oxygen. They bring them the organic carbon that they like to eat.
Yeah, exactly. And those currents then, because at the surface, I mean, we've all heard of some of the big currents like the Gulf Stream and things like that. And we've heard of kind of that. I don't know how many of you have heard of that big story of the rubber ducks that got spilled off the ship. And still to this day, 20 years later, they're washing up on various beaches. They've gone global. So the currents on the surface are normally quite fast, but I presume near the sea floor, they're a bit more sluggish, slower? Does it vary?
It varies significantly. Yep. So deep waters don't necessarily run still. So in many places, they can be quite slow. But where these conveyor belts meet different types of seafloor character, they can be funneled, like when you put your thumb over the end of a hose pipe, it gets squirted out like a jet. So that's very much what we found in the Tyrrhenian Sea. most of these currents are of the order kind of tens of centimeters per second, so you'd have no problem really outrunning them.
Yeah.
but other things that get funneled down submarine canyons, these avalanches of sediment called turbidity currents, and the things that break cables as well, they can reach tens of meters per second.
Wow.
So this is the thing that you can't outrun if you happen to be in a submarine canyon at the time.
Yeah. So how do they actually end up from the surface and get down into the deep sea? How long does that take? I guess that varies as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and I wish I had an answer for it, really. What we do know is that plastics have been going into the ocean for decades, so we have a very long legacy of plastics.
Yeah.
And some people have started looking at different early types of plastics and saying, well, can you work out the onset from looking at sediment cores that we take from the deep sea floor? You effectively have, when you open up your core, effectively a book you can flick back through in time to see that's before plastics and this is the start of plastics and this is how it's changing. But there's so much we don't know about how plastics age, how they degrade. What we do know is that they have what we call an extremely long environmental residence time. So they're very, very durable.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why we love plastic, because it's a very useful material.
Exactly, yeah.
But at the same time, they can be in the ocean for a significant amount of time. They may even end up settling on the seafloor, and then another flow comes through and whips them up again. So we don't have an answer. But we have some handle on the processes now that transport them from the shelf to the deep sea and across the deep sea. But these are still only at a handful of sites. So we do need to make more observations and actually go and sample the seafloor. We need to measure the currents that are actually transporting these microplastics. And then we rely on models. So it's the models that allow us to upscale this to a global picture. But there's a lot of question marks, which is a good thing from a researcher, because it means there's lots of questions to answer, but also about exactly how microplastics behave. I've been studying sediments, so quartz, sand, and bits of clay and silt. We have a pretty good understanding of how those things behave. And so when a current interacts with them, we can pretty much well guess where they're going to end up.
Yeah.
For microplastics, they're weird shapes, they're different densities, they can break up and become smaller, they can get eaten by organisms and then excreted out and then form these kind of agglomerations, kind of clumps of microplastics and other stuff that the organism's eaten. And all these things change along its kind of pathway through the ocean. And it involves every bit of the ocean. So it's why it's an interesting problem to tackle as well, because you need lots and lots of different people working on this.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. And I guess, well, this is a very active area of research, not just for you, but I guess for the NOC and for lots of other institutes around the world. But I'm quite interested in, so how do you actually go about studying this? Maybe you could give us an example from one of your recent studies about what you actually did to study this, especially using the observations and the models, if you like.
Yeah, so I'll probably come back to the study in the Tyrrhenian Sea. So in the Western Mediterranean, this is an area where we've been working with collaborators in France from IFREMER and other organisations who had previously deployed current meters to make measurements of what the bottom currents were doing and what the water masses are actually doing. They'd from that developed numerical models that allow us to understand exactly how the currents are working in that area. We've fortunately acquired some sediment cores in an area that they had characterized very, very well. So we took a number of samples from different types of seafloor that the currents interact with differently and basically look at those sediments, and we separate out the microplastics from the rest of the sediment. And then basically count the number of microplastics we see. We also look at the different types of microplastic we see. So we use different bits of kit, things like an FTIR, which basically gives us a chemical fingerprint of what the different types of plastics are. So we can discern nylon from polyethylene and different types of plastic. And look at the concentrations and the types of microplastics relative to the different currents. That tells us where they end up. Tells us what the currents were doing. It doesn't actually show us how they're being transported. So other things that we've done in collaboration with colleagues at Utrecht University is using what they call the Eurotank, but it's a huge kind of like an aquarium that we can put different things into. So here we've released lots of microplastics at the top of the tank, and we let them run through one of these sediment avalanches, and then we see where they end up. And we found some surprising things, because microplastics quite often are very light, particularly the fibres, these things that can be blown to the top of Mount Everest. But those same fibers we were finding trapped right in the deposits at the bottom of these flows that were running down the canyon. And it seems because of their shape, they actually get trapped between sand grains, and these avalanches naturally bury these microplastics. So they might actually be a force for good in this case. Whilst they break cables, they may also be just trapping and burying those microplastics, taking them out of availability for organisms that might want to munch on them.
Yeah. Have you done any research yourself or anyone in your team about the effect on organisms?
Yeah, so Alice Horton, mm-hmm. who works as a part of the microplastics research group at the Oceanography Centre, is really focused very much on that. And so she's a world expert in not just microplastics, but what we call kind of ecotoxicology. So trying to understand the impacts. And in many cases, microplastics don't have an obvious impact on different organisms. And that's because maybe the plastic themselves, that's inert and may not be that harmful. But it's things that bind to the surface of microplastics, kind of toxic materials, I think that Richard Lampitt will have talked about. The question is how available those things are to different organisms and the rates at which they interact with them. A lot of laboratory experiments have exposed different organisms to very, very high concentrations to try and look at what the problem levels are. But that's not necessarily what's happening in the real world. Yeah. So Alice's work has been looking at kind of instantaneous impacts as well as prolonged but low-level impacts. And it's probably fair to say that the jury's still out on that. We still need to gather more evidence and more data.
Yeah.
But the two approaches go hand in hand. Yes. We're trying to understand how much of the stuff there is out there and where it ends up, which part of the ecosystem does it actually interact with. Then Alice's work very much picks up from there and says, well, what should we be worried about? What sorts of levels are going to be an issue?
I guess there's still so much more to do, as this is kind of, I don't want to call it a new area of research, but it is kind of untapped, if you like. Because if you're saying a lot of these microplastics are getting trapped in the kind of deep sea canyons, I can't imagine that we've studied all of them. So there's probably still quite a lot to investigate.
It's definitely reassuring for me as a researcher, but also frustrating as well. There's maybe 9,000 of these submarine canyons around the world. And they generally fall below the resolution of a lot of the ocean numerical models that we have. The flows that go through them, we don't fully understand the physics of them. And until maybe the last 10 years or so, we had never made direct measurements of the flows that move through these canyons. New technology has allowed us to do that, and that's really exciting. But at the moment, we've maybe made measurements of flows in 10 canyons worldwide, and that's we as in the collective global community of researchers working on this issue. But it is possible, and we are able to make those measurements, and are finding all sorts of exciting things about how these flows potentially pose a hazard to seafloor infrastructure, but also what they carry. So things like microplastics, the organic carbon that sustains deep sea benthic communities.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I want to turn briefly to one of your latest pieces of research about the Congo canyons. So I was reading about this the other day, and it was so I think it finds that river floods essentially can cause lots of plastic to enter the deep sea, and that's a new finding.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we know that rivers are one of the biggest agents for transporting sediment on the planet, and then we also know that rivers can be quite important for transporting microplastics to the ocean. So that's quite well understood. What happens beyond there, there's lots of question marks.
Exactly,
So the Congo River is the second biggest river in the world in terms of the water that it kind of spits out to the ocean. Offshore from that is one of the biggest submarine canyon systems on the planet that goes all the way down to 5 kilometres water depth over a distance of about 1,500 kilometres, kind of a wiggly meandering channel that ends up in what we call a submarine fan. That's the ultimate resting place for all the sediment that used to be in the river. We've never made detailed measurements of a flow within such a big system from what we call source to sink, so from the head of the canyon down to the fan. But a recent NERC funded project that was led by Durham University that I contributed to has made the first measurements, and we've been able to track a huge sediment avalanche that traveled 1200 kilometers down to the deep sea, reaching speeds of up to about 8 meters per second.
Oh, wow, that's pretty fast for the deep sea.
And it was speeding up 1,000 kilometers from the head of the canyon.
Oh, so
I find those distances quite hard to,
I know,
to fathom. But
yeah,
this flow was vast, and we had deployed a number of different sensors along the canyon in the hope that maybe we'd record one or two smallish sort of events. We previously thought that these sorts of flows maybe happened on hundreds or thousands of years timescale. Mm. Actually, within a few months of putting the instruments in, we started getting alerts from the instruments on the seafloor, and they were no longer on the seafloor. They were now floating up on the surface, and something had come through and had sequentially cut the connections,
wow,
from all of these sensors to the seafloor and caused them to float to the surface. At the same time, we were also contacted by a couple of cable companies who have cables that cross this canyon to say, do you know anything about what's happening in the Congo Canyon?
Yeah.
we've just lost internet connection.
Oh, interesting.
And so the timings of all of these instruments coming up to the surface and the cable breaks told us about these flows. But research that's currently ongoing with collaborators in Plymouth and Durham University is demonstrating that this flow also transported a huge amount of organic carbon and seems to have also transported a significant amount of microplastics with it.
Mm.
So these events are kind of flushing all the stuff that builds,
yeah,
up within the canyon. These flows were eroding and picking up loads of sediment like a snow avalanche,
yeah,
tearing all the way down to the deep sea.
Yeah, wow. So was that just fortunate that you were kind of in the right place at the right time for this kind of event to happen, or is it actually more frequent than...
Everywhere we seem to put instruments in submarine canyons,
we
find something. I don't think we're doing it, but it seems like canyons in particular and much of the deep sea is actually far more active and vigorous than we had previously thought.
Yeah.
And this is because we've had to study, this is where I come from as a geologist, we look at sediment cores,
yeah,
we look at the deposits they leave behind. But it's a very incomplete record because these flows can erode the seafloor, they can rework those deposits. So we were probably out by, our understanding of how frequent and powerful these flows were is being corrected now by the observations,
yeah,
that we're making.
That is fascinating. My mind is kind of blown a little bit because all of my research is, well, most of my research kind of focuses on the kind of upper ocean, so
yeah,
near the,
yeah,
surface. And my perspective was always that it was kind of sluggish on the seafloor, but actually, no, perhaps not everywhere.
No, I mean, for a large part of the ocean, I'm sure that holds true.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
But it's certainly interesting. A lot of the studies of microplastics that have looked at the accumulations on the surface, when asking, well, where does it end up, they've assumed it settles vertically out through the water column. And the research that we're doing, that Richard Katzier is doing,
yeah,
here at NOC, is demonstrating that ocean currents play a really important role. And we shouldn't be surprised by this. It's actually very intuitive. In the same way as microplastics get blown in the wind,
yes,
of course, even weak currents can play,
yeah,
an important,
absolutely,
control on them.
Yeah. And how do models come into all this? How do they help?
I hope they do help.
We do.
So models allow us to then translate the observations that we have at a few point locations to look at this over a bigger picture. It clearly needs calibration, so it needs that stamp collecting. I think fairly recently a lot of the literature around microplastics on the seafloor was, there's this much here, there's this much here, there's that much there. That's useful, but in and of itself, it doesn't take us a step further.
Yeah.
So we need the contextual information that goes with it. What are the currents that operate in those sorts of areas? And models allow us to fill in the gaps between observational points.
Of course, yeah.
But they are imperfect, and they're imperfect also because we don't fully understand the behavior of microplastics.
Yeah,
so
of
if you change the shape, the density,
yeah,
of the microplastics, it will behave differently in the model. So again, as I said, it's exciting because it means there's lots of experiments to be done. There's lots of observations to make. And then it links into say, work that Alice Horton does,
yes,
here as well, of also what do we care about? We could,
yes,
work back from that. So which types of microplastics are we most concerned about, and how do they get transported? Can we link their kind of ultimate resting point to the sources,
yeah,
and track that pollution pathway?
Yeah, no, I understand. So I think... some of the work you've talked about already is kind of talking about those canyons that are kind of fairly close to the land,
yeah,
kind of attached, as we call them.
Yeah.
Have you done anything, any work on detached canyons, as in land-detached canyons?
Yeah.
Does it look any different from those close to the kind of source of the plastics, or...?
Yeah, so this is something I've been really interested in recently, and we've been part of a program called CLASS here, which is Natural Environment Research Council funded large project studying the North Atlantic. And one of the canyons in the Northeast Atlantic is called the Wittard Canyon.
Yes.
It's the UK's only submarine canyon, so it gives me a good excuse to study submarine canyons. And other colleagues like Villa Huvena here at NAC have been studying that canyon for a long time. And it's important because it's teeming with life.
Yeah.
I was less excited by this canyon because most of the canyons we have been studying recently that I get quite excited by either connect directly to rivers like the Congo Canyon or they're fed by a longshore drift.
Yes.
So there's a canyon offshore California called the Monterey Canyon. Mm-hmm. And there you can throw a beach from shore and you could land a stone in the head of the canyon.
Yeah.
So it's quite obvious how this links from land to the deep
exactly.
sea. In the Wittard Canyon, the head of the canyon lies more than 200 kilometres from the nearest bit of land. And so it's thought, or at least it has been thought until fairly recently, that these sorts of canyons only feature turbidity currents, these avalanches of sediment, when sea levels are much lower. So that would be about 20,000 years ago, during the last glaciation. We put some instruments and some sensors down in the canyon, and I didn't expect to find anything very interesting. And then we pulled them out after a year and found that the frequency of these turbidity currents is about the same as in the Congo Canyon and in Monterey Canyon, these systems that are directly connected to land. And they reach speeds of 8 meters per second. This is the same speed and intensity that we see in other systems. And it didn't make any sense to us. Like, how would you get these flows? What's triggering them? But we also see them transporting litter. So our moorings that we deployed with the sensors on them, around the mooring anchors and lines, we found lots of fishing gear, other bits of litter and plastic. So these flows are definitely transporting plastic. Mm. We're running analysis at University of Manchester with collaborators there to see how much microplastics that they're transporting. But they clearly are doing that based on preliminary results. But these canyons represent maybe 3/4 of all of the submarine canyons worldwide.
Oh, okay.
And so we now think that potentially we've really underestimated the role of these canyons in connecting continental shelves, so shallow water, all the way down to the deep sea. And this is maybe a missing kind of connection that we hadn't previously thought operated in the present day.
Yeah, well, that's really fascinating. So still so much to do.
So much to do, yeah.
Which is good for you, I guess. So all of this research is obviously really important, and we touched on it lightly at the beginning, but I was wondering what kind of impact it has on society.
Yeah, and it's a good question. I mean, in part, these plastics are really useful kind of tracers. So I'm really interested in if we can see how these plastics get transported, it helps us understand the currents that transport them that also pose hazards in a really similar way to... You know, there's often sometimes positive outcomes from bad events. So the Deepwater Horizon incident in the Gulf of Mexico released a huge amount of oil that floated on the surface of the ocean. But using satellite images, oceanographers have been able to reconstruct the currents, the loop currents that operate there, based on how oil gets transported. So one way is us better understanding the hazards. But in reality, I think when we think about plastics in the ocean, I think when most people think about plastics in the ocean, they think about these floating garbage patches. They think about very charismatic animals with bits of plastic around their necks. That's important, but also understanding where else plastic goes in the ocean and where it's coming from. Whatever happens, we've got decades of legacy plastic waste that we're not going to be able to do much about. Mm. But we can start to change our behaviour. And I think by getting an understanding of where stuff is coming from, you know, what the sources are for this plastic, if we can start tracking it back to the source, then it means you can more meaningfully mitigate that. You can start to address it in an appropriate manner. But at the moment, we kind of say, well, there's an awful lot of plastic in the ocean. We think it comes from all sorts of different places. We think it gets transported by these different manners. If we get a better understanding from its source to its endpoint, we can do something, you know, and it's about turning that tap off rather than mopping up,
absolutely.
Up the ocean.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I've certainly learned a lot. So to keep up to date with the microplastics team, head over to our website, knock.ac.uk, and follow us across social media. If you're enjoying Into the Blue, you can show your support by subscribing on your favourite podcast app, leaving us a rating and telling your friends and family all about us.